When we talk about the French Revolution, it's easy to jump into the chaos, the guillotines, the fiery speeches, the fall of kings. But before the streets erupted, there was a long, slow pressure building beneath the surface. A pressure created by the people who had the least, yet carried the most. For decades leading up to 1789, France looked powerful from the outside. Grand palaces, divine right monarchy, a culture admired across Europe. But internally, the system was cracking. The monarchy had piled up enormous debt, partly from helping the American colonies fight Britain. Taxes were squeezed out of the poorest citizens, while the nobility and clergy lived exempt and comfortable. And then, as if history wanted to underscore the injustice, a series of poor harvests hit the country. Bread, the most basic staple, became scarce and impossibly expensive. The people who depended on it most, the working class and peasants, felt squeezed first and hardest. But here's where the revolutionary spirit sparks. It wasn't just suffering, it was awakening. Ideas from the Enlightenment were spreading. Pamphlets, discussions in coffee houses, whispered conversations in crowded markets. Ordinary people were hearing new messages that power could belong to citizens, that government could be held accountable, that inequality could be challenged. These weren't just radical theories, they became tools for survival. By the time King Louis XVI called the Estates General, an assembly meant to solve the financial crisis, the Third Estate, the common people, had already begun to imagine a different France. And when they were pushed aside once again, they collectivized. They formed the National Assembly. They declared themselves the legitimate voice of the nation. It was the moment the lower class stopped asking for change and just started creating it. The revolution didn't begin with the fall of Bastille. It began long before, in breadlines, in whispered ideas, in a shared belief among ordinary people that together they could bend history. If the French Revolution showed the world how collective struggle can reshape a nation, the centuries that followed proved that revolutionary spirit doesn't vanish. It evolves, it resurfaces, and it inspires new movements across continents. In the United States, the Black Panther Party emerged in the 1960s from that same truth that drove people into the streets of Paris. When systems fail to recognize human dignity, people organize to reclaim it. The Panthers weren't just a symbol of resistance. They built free breakfast programs, health clinics, community patrols, structures created by the people, for the people, in places where the government had long ignored them. Their message was clear. Collective empowerment can transform communities long before policy ever catches up. That spirit, organization grounded in survival, dignity, and solidarity, has echoed far beyond the U.S. Across the world, other movements rose from similar pressures and aspirations. The Bolsheviks in Russia mobilized workers and peasants who were crushed by war and inequality, envisioning a society where power came from below rather than above. In Nicaragua, the Sandinistas channeled decades of frustration under dictatorship into a coordinated popular movement built on education, literacy, and land reform. And in places still fighting for self-determination today, from Palestinian communities striving for sovereignty and human rights, to citizens in Burkina Faso challenging corruption and foreign influence, the heart of revolutionary energy remains the same. It is not simply the push for political change. It is the belief that ordinary people, united, can reclaim control over their lives and futures. Throughout history, revolution has never belonged solely to the armies or politicians. It belongs to neighborhoods, to workers, to students, to families who refuse to accept the world as it is. Whether in the 18th century France, 20th century Oakland, or modern struggles for justice across the globe, the spark is always lit from the ground up. All this talk of collective strength reminds me of something far quieter, but just as revolutionary. Something found not in city streets, but in forests. In the book, The Hidden Life of Trees, Peter Wohlleben tells a story that stops you in your tracks. He describes coming across what looked like an old, dead tree stump, just a remnant of something long gone. But when he carved into it, he didn't find dry, lifeless wood. He found green, living tissue, stored chlorophyll. The stump was alive. And the reason it was alive was even more remarkable. The surrounding trees, its neighbors, had been feeding it through interconnected root systems and fungal networks. They shared nutrients, energy, and support. Even though the stump could give nothing back, the community around it refused to let it die. Wohlleben's discovery reminds us that strength isn't just about standing tall. It's about holding one another up. We all have someone in our vicinity who may look like they've run out of life, out of energy, out of hope. But just like the forest, we have the ability to share what we have. Care, time, resources, encouragement. In the book of John, Jesus said that you love one another as I have loved you. No one has greater love than this, to lay down one's life for one's friends. Because survival isn't a solo act, it's a collective one. In this episode, I invited Mark Wayne of the Colonial Outcast podcast on to talk further about this revolutionary spirit. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Hello and welcome to Grub and Grace, the podcast that you would think I would talk about food more, but I don't. But I probably should. I'm your host, Mark Flower, and I'm joined today by Mark Wayne of the Colonial Outcast podcast, an anti-imperialist platform which will inevitably piss off your conservative uncle while informing you about the roots under fascism, capitalism, and white supremacy, that being the Imperial Colonial Empire. Mark, aside from having the best first name in the world, is an ex-Army National Guardsman who used to be an evangelical Zionist and almost joined the IDF in 2005, but fell in love with the Palestinian people instead. Did I get all that right, Mark?
Yeah. Yep, sure did. And by the way, nobody said we can't talk about food, too.
I love it. Let's talk about food, too. I mean, if we're talking about Palestinians, I actually attempted to make some Palestinian recipes as part of my kind of creative outlet and everything like that. I could share those with you, too, if you want.
Oh, heck yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you can't talk about Palestine without talking about their food. I always say that there's seven main pillars of Palestine. It's faith, family, friends, foreigners, food, soccer, and football. Cigarettes is the seventh one. So cigarettes and soccer, those are the seven pillars of Palestine. Guarantee you that.
Now what about like hookah? I know you talked about like smoking and everything like that. Do they do a lot of hookah over there as well?
I'm clumping hookah in with cigarettes. Yeah, let's just call it tobacco. Well, let's say tobacco. Yeah, I got my nicotine habit from the Palestinians. Haven't been able to break it since day one. But yeah, I smoked a lot of hookah with them and a lot of cigarettes. But yeah, their tradition is eating food. They have these cafes, hookah cafes, where you always see two OG, older, classy Palestinian dudes sitting with their legs crossed, with their back straight, smoking hookah and then gossiping. And there's always two of them at every cafe. And when you ever... you're a foreigner and you come in and sit down at the cafe, they're just looking at you, smiling at you, and then probably talking about you. So it's a Palestine staple.
Oh, man, I love it.
Yeah.
Now, I know you've spent a lot of time in Palestine and around the world too. You've mentioned even like, you know, living in like South Korea and also Palestine as well and all that, which kind of resonates China. With me. I've actually lived in South Korea as well.
Oh, nice.
China and all those. I know I mentioned you almost joining the IDF, so the Israeli Defense Forces, as a Christian Zionist. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've heard your testimony before, and it's something that really resonated with me. It made me love you as a person. And I was wondering, would you be able to kind of share at least some of your story briefly or however long you want to do it?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was born, you know, into a, you know, a Christian family that we changed churches all the time. My godparents were African Zimbabwe immigrants, and I was co-parented and co-raised by them. And they all went on to school to get their theology degrees. And my mom was at attended Oral Roberts University, which I'm sure you might be aware of, a very heavy evangelical. It's like it's the beating heart of evangelicalism in the United States, for sure.
Yep.
And my dad joined as a chaplain in the Army. So we grew up on military bases. And wherever we moved, we would try to find the best church to fit. And oftentimes they were evangelical. Sometimes they were Baptist. Just depended on where we were. And so when fifth move, which was Kansas City, when my dad was stationed at Fort Leavenworth, we found a evangelical church, which was Sheffield Family Life Center. Heavy Zionist church. I mean, every Wednesday they dedicated to end times prophecies about Israel being the chosen people and how they fulfill this narrative in the Bible about being oppressed by its neighbors and getting conquered by the Gentiles, all that stuff, you know. And that was when I was around, that's like, we're talking a time period of like maybe 11 to 15 years old. So in that frame, those few years, I was really heavily impacted by these, you know, apocalyptic pro, you know, Zionist indoctrination. And so, you know, as a young kid, you don't know any better because this is like, you know, this is early 2000s. So there wasn't like social media or videos or conflicting information. You'd have to go read a book. So I was victim to that propaganda machine that goes from the top down. Like these churches are heavily lobbied and have very tight collaboration with Israel directly, to the point where it's almost a military strategy. So that trickles down to, you know, naive people like I was. And that definitely turned me, you know, Zionized me, I guess. And so I got the compulsion, well, because I was I wanted to be and live the faith and live out my belief system. I'm like, well, I want to go to Israel, join the IDF. So when I graduated in Utah, when we were on Dugway Proving Ground, which is like a classified military base where they test chemical and biological weapons. And my dad, he was the installation chaplain there. So I asked my parents, can I go to Israel and study at Hebrew University? They said, yeah. So my intention was that I was going to go there, assimilate with Israeli society, and then join the IDF because I thought these were the chosen people of God. This is what the Bible was talking about. Why wouldn't I want to be a part of that? You know, they're so oppressed and so targeted by all these vicious countries that surround them. That's the narrative I believed and lived. So obviously I'm going to go over there and try to join. And I get there to Hebrew University in Jerusalem, fell in love with Jerusalem. Absolutely fell in love with it. And then a huge mistake happened. The Israeli staff at the Hebrew University assigned me to a dorm floor and a dorm room that they would assign different people when you go through the student line. And, you know, and they just, student office, they just write on a piece of paper, okay, here's your dorm, here's your room, go ahead, go get comfortable. Well, the dorm floor that they assigned me to was full of Palestinian Muslims. Now, what comes along with Zionism in every church is Islamophobia. You have to put two and two together. Whenever you're talking about Israel and you're a Zionist, you've got to throw in the Islamophobia because in their minds, the Islamophobia, Islam, fits the other apocalyptic narrative that Islam is this, you know, aggressive, sweeping, dictatorial religion that's just swallowing the globe and wants to destroy the people of God. That's the other narrative they put with it. So I'm brainwashed into a lot of Islamophobia, thinking that they're these monsters. And I get there and the dorm floor is full of very loud, funny, you know, outgoing Palestinian Muslims. And I got to argue with them the first night. I get there, I walk in. their dorm room. I walked straight in their dorm room and started an argument. Just because I was just that kind of guy. I was the type of guy that wanted to get right into debates, you know. And they got into it with me. And there was a lot of back and forth, heated debates, yelling, screaming, joking. But then I realized that the debates were at this level of honesty and not holding back what we're going to say to each other, that it was almost a very intimate thing. You know, there's something about arguing with somebody to the point where you're not pulling any punches, that there is an intimacy that forms. And I realized, like, man, I can't do this with anybody. Like, there's nobody I could argue with like this. Like, they're playing ball. They're swatting down all my arguments and they're educating me. And we're talking like all the way to like 1 a.m. in the morning. We're having these arguments. And then I just felt the bond forming. I'm like, I really like these guys. And I just wound up, you know, being one of those friendships where you're just like, man, these guys, like, they might be like brutally honest with me, but they're ride or die. So, and that led me on this path to getting to know Palestine from day one. And that was not the intentions that I had going to Israel. I was not supposed to go that way, you know?
I love that, man. It's one of those things that I wish more people would get out of their comfort zone and be around people and actually spend time with people outside of their cultural circle. Mm. You know, like, I got a lot of white friends and usually the majority of their friends in their circles are other white, you know, if it's like a white man, it's usually other white men or maybe, you know, their spouses or something like that. And so I don't really see them ever getting out of their circle and traveling to another country, living in another country, even just within their different communities, and finding, you know, people from different cultural backgrounds. And,
right.
You know, like I mentioned, I lived in Korea for a little bit and I was able to, you know, mesh with the Korean people over there. And it kind of broke me out of my shell of being an American and mm-hmm. and exposing me to, well, maybe the world's a lot bigger than I really thought it was. And just how important it is to shape our worldview and how we view other people, too, and to not be so closed-minded to everything. So I think it's so beautiful that you had that experience that kind of broke you out of your bubble and allowed you to see a bigger world than what it really is.
Yeah. And like I said, it was unintentional.
Mm-hmm. So you and your co-host Greg have taught me like so many terms on your show, and one of them being the Imperial Boomerang, which is, you know, the weapons and tactics that the Empire, in this case America, uses overseas will one day come back around and be used on its own citizens. And so, with that term kind of in mind, like, why is Palestine, as well as places like the Congo, Sudan, Venezuela, way more important than what, like, you know, liberals think it is, or like, you know, just general Americans think it is?
Yeah, you know, this brings up it's a good question. I had a talk. I only have two liberal friends in my life, just two. I keep it to two. But one I was having a conversation with that maybe I need to work on. You talked about reaching out to people and maybe I need to do that more with liberals. But I had a conversation with one and I was telling him about how much Obama did, like how he built Democrats and Republicans together, built the throne that Trump now sits on, and that all this tyranny is. It didn't happen overnight. It wasn't just, it's not one guy who took office. It's a process of building it brick by brick. And Obama, with, you know, killing thousands overseas with his drone program, when I explained this to liberals, they said, well, they always come back with this, you know, it's just the most cliche comeback. It's, well, every president does that. So it's like they're accepting the fact that slaughtering people overseas and using our military might on other people and destroying their country, it just comes with the package and we need to accept that. It comes with the package of American presidents. And my rebuttal to that is, well, you do understand that that attitude is what is going to destroy us here. Even if you don't care about the thousands of lives that were killed under Obama or any other Democratic president or Trump or anybody or any Republican president, even if you don't care about that, let's just say you're really like that. You're that type of person. Well, it's going to come here. It's going to come here a thousand times. And the ones that you love are going to be affected by it. So everything that we're doing to other people overseas, it's merely a testing ground for what is going to happen to Americans. So if you don't care about those people, which you should, if you claim to be, you know, compassionate or empathetic, then at least care about yourself, you know, care about your own turf where you stand, because it is going to come home to roost when they run out of people that they can oppress overseas. So.
Mm-hmm. And I know you guys have talked about, I know Greg has brought up Martin Niemöller's poem, First They Came, which criticizes the complacency and disregard for social justice and for speaking out what Jesus would call, you know, the least of these.
Yes.
You know, like, it's just an importance of why we must speak up for people that are normally marginalized and pushed aside or demonized as terrorists. Because like you said, you know, first, you know, the system, the empire will come for them, but then the weapons that they'll use for that, the tactics, the mind control, all that kind of stuff will swing back around right for us too. And it's kind of that whole thing of like, why we need to stand up for those who are being deported by ICE as well. And, you know, like Mexican people and Latin people that are here in America that are being targeted specifically by ICE agents, and why we need to speak up and stand up for them, for their rights, because, you know, there's orders even to about the homeless, even mm-hmm. about, you know, a lot of people think like, oh, good, you know, get them off the streets. But the order states that it's people that have, you know, alcohol abuse, mental disorder, various other things like that. And that could be a wide stretch of things. Like, have you ever gone to treatment for alcoholism, or have you ever been to, you know, counseling for maybe like some mental breakdown or something like that you had at some point, but maybe mm-hmm. you're better now. They could use that past to come for you as well. Mm-hmm. And just because you're not standing up for the marginalized, the people that are, you know, lower in societal rank, you know, it doesn't mean that they're not going to come for you as well.
No, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's a feeling of safety when, like there's this attitude of, well, I'm in the core of the empire. I'm valued more than these people. I'm white. I'm Christian. Mm-hmm. I'm not a marginalized group, so I'm safe for now. So, you know, why should I care? And it's a false feeling. It's an illusion that they're in, because their stake in the game, as they think that they have, is merely just a temporary platitude to keep them complacent with it and make them part of the power structure until they don't need you anymore. Now, from a spiritual mm-hmm. perspective, if we're from a Christian perspective, you quoted a very good verse, which is the analogy of the sheep and the goats. It's my favorite one. And I use this analogy when I talk to Christians about atheists. Because a lot of Christians have this, you know, attitude that they're redeemed and they're saved. And for just because they took out the life insurance policy of being a Christian. And I tell them that, like, I believe that analogy that Jesus gave, the parable of the sheep and the goats, was a quote on atheists and people who aren't necessarily Christian. So the way that Jesus lays out the analogy, he basically says, for the audience who doesn't know, the parable of the sheep and the goats, Jesus says to the sheep, at the end of the age, at judgment day, I'll be separating the sheep and the goats. And I'll say to the sheep, you fed me when I was hungry. You clothed me when I was naked. You visited me when I was in prison. Come into eternal life. And the sheep will say, when did we do this? When did we feed you? When did we give you water? When did we clothe you? And Jesus said, when you did it to the least of these, you did it to me. And then he's going to say the opposite to the goats. He's going to say, you didn't clothe me. You didn't feed me. And they'll say, when didn't we do that? Well, so the impression I get from that is the sheep are confused. The sheep are baffled that they're going to eternal life. Like, we don't even know you. Why are we going to eternal life? The way I translate that is, these are people who they don't know God. They don't know Jesus. They don't know anything. They're just like, I was just doing what I was supposed to do. And Jesus said, yeah, and that's all I wanted you to do. So congratulations, you're going to heaven. And so that's how I translate that parable. I really do translate it that way, because the sheep were confused. This is how what I tell Christians who think that they're Christian, of what's going to happen to all the people who are not Christian at the end of the age, all the people who stood up against oppression, atheists, maybe even people who hate God, maybe people who absolutely hate religion or in general. It doesn't matter if they hate God. They did what he told them to do. And I don't think God's going to care. I think God, when they get there, God's going to be like, hey, you may have hated me. You may have not been a Christian, but guess what? You did exactly what I told you to do. So congratulations, you're in. That's how I translate that. And it's ironic that Christians are have been the deadliest force in the history of mankind. Like, you know, Holocaust after Holocaust, wars after wars. And people who aren't Christian tended to be on the side of fighting that. So it really does fulfill the prophecy that Jesus said about regarding this parable. And there's more parables he said that kind of go along those lines as well. But yeah, it's the irony behind it that always strikes me with this hypocrisy. And Jesus called it. Like, he prophesied about all these things that would happen in the future, about people claiming, I will go, those who go to me and say, Lord, Lord, and he says, depart from me, I never knew you. He's saying, I don't even recognize you. You didn't do any of the things that I said to do, but you think that just by calling me Lord, that you had that label, that you're part of the flock. You're not, you know? So anyways,
which is funny, because I actually consider Jesus to be one of the first Antifa out there, and then Christians are the one that are...
Christians are the Pharisees now? Yeah, it's funny how those rules switched. The Pharisees have been the Christian church for a long time. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm, for sure. So I kind of want to jump back to the voting process of why people put so much stock into it. So this last election cycle, I didn't actually vote for either of the major established parties. Mm-hmm. I voted for Jill Stein and Butch Ware, mm-hmm. because I felt that they had the people's best interest in mind. Mm-hmm. But whenever I tell people, like especially my liberal leaning friends and family, that I voted that way, I usually get a response like, why would you throw your vote away? Or there's no way they could win. Or you allowed Trump to happen or something like that. So like my question for you, and I know you're probably gonna have a good response for this, is why do we put so much stock into like the voting process? And why does it seem that no matter who we vote for, it doesn't really make much of a difference in the average lives of Americans, like no matter if a Democrat or Republican gets elected?
It's a good question. It's interesting. I've been thinking about that a lot, about how this electoral duty, I guess you can say, has been pushed on Americans that voting, you need to go vote and you need to vote for one of the two parties. It's kind of in some ways replaced religion in a certain extent. See, religion tells you to believe in a higher power and have faith. And it's your duty to abide by the laws of that faith, because you just have to have faith that it's going to work. Well, the democratic system we have set up is like that. It's a religion. It's this faith that if you violate that and you don't believe it, it's kind of like being an atheist. Like, what? You're not going to vote? It's like sin. It's a sin. And so in many ways, I believe that the reason why we put so much stock in it, it's psychological. I believe that it's the human compulsion to believe in a higher power. And a voting system has kind of replaced that. Like, where religion would be, or spirituality would be, you have electoral politics. And it's that void that people fill within them, where, yes, they feel like they don't have control over their surroundings, but they can pray. And the version of prayer is putting in the ballot, right? And so that's been something that I've been thinking about. I think it is deeply psychological, where human beings want to feel like they're in control. And that's reinforced by constant messaging, by the duopoly, by the uniparty. It's constantly telling you, you need to get out and vote. You know, big billboard signs, get out and vote. And even you tell your friends, go tell your friends to get out and vote. It's very much similar to, hey, you need to go to church. You need to pray. Just have faith. It's replacing that inclination. And it's also laziness. It's a laziness, because if you can put – it doesn't take a lot of effort to vote. What? You put on a ballot, or maybe you shoot some memes supporting your candidate, or maybe go to a rally, or maybe pass out some signs, whatever. That's very easy to do, and it's very lazy. Building community, right? Building a physical community, assembling a council in your neighborhood to vote on things in the neighborhood. Like, somebody, so-and-so needs help with their bills. Can we all vote to see if we can put in a pot for that person? Just like the early church did. The earliest churches were collectivized, essentially communist, you know, but you don't use that word. It's just, they were a collectivized structure. Their goal was to make sure that everybody in the community was lifted out of poverty. The first disciples who, I mean, we're talking like literally like a few years after Jesus ascended to heaven, that's what the church was doing. They were collectivizing. Early form of a form of communism, I guess you could call it, or intercommunalism. But so what's been replaced with that is, instead of collectivizing, instead of organizing in a physical level with your neighborhoods, you can detach from all that go and vote or go and support a candidate or support a color, red or blue, and you've done your part for your community. So it's just swapped out that responsibility with something that completely, and it's been very effective, you know, because we're a nation of convenience. We're addicted to convenience, and building community is not convenient. Voting is very convenient. So that's my answer to that.
I love that. I knew you'd have some like a good response for that. It's all the things that I've thought about the party too. And like, I've always found it very difficult to have put words behind it. Like when people bring it up, I'm like, I blank. And then I don't know what to say. So
because I totally know that feeling too. You don't think I go through that? I'm sometimes where I'm talking to people who are liberal. I'm just like, I have no words. I don't even know where to start. Cause it's just a mountain of stuff that I could throw at. I don't know which one to pick. It's just like, I get it, dude. I get it.
Oh, for sure, man. So in one of my previous episodes, I talked about the 20th century Italian Marxist philosopher, politician, and anti-fascist, Antonio Gramsci. Mm-hmm. And he said that the vast majority of people adopt the worldview and the ways of thinking of the ruling groups. And unless something snaps and they get a radically different perspective on things, they tend to view the world from that very hegemonic position of the rulers. In the same episode, I actually referenced you using a term called social judo, in which the state redirects the momentum of revolutionary spirit away from meaningful revolutionary change. What are some ways that you have seen like this idea play out in the real world here?
Ooh, where do I start with that? Yeah. I believe I mentioned that term on a podcast with Butch Ware way back. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so basically the idea is in judo. Judo is the theory behind judo is when you're wrestling with somebody and they're forcing a momentum on you, you simply redirect it against them. So like you can redirect their energy that if they're going this way, then you just step out of the way and then put your leg in front and then swing them over. So they're using their own momentum against themselves. So this is how Gramsci puts it way better than I can. But that was the analogy in my mind, and it is. What is done to movements, such as, for example, like you asked, the Black Panther movement, right? 1966, mm-hmm. Huey P. Newton, Bobby Seale start the Black Panther movement, which was real. It was tangible. They built community. They built self-defense systems, food programs, SNAP, WIC. All of that was started by the Black Panthers, real things that fed the people. And that was so dangerous, though. It was so dangerous to the empire because now it gave people this revelation that, wait a minute, we can do this for each other. We don't need the state apparatus that is corrupt to do it for us. We don't need the Republicans and Democrats. We can do it ourselves. That's why, you know, all guns were aimed at the Panthers. Now, but after the Panthers were taken down by COINTELPRO and the FBI, there was still a problem that the empire had on its hands because, you know, the Panthers were still in recent memory. They didn't want there to be They didn't want to take the risk of another movement like that forming even and stronger than ever. So they had to make some concessions. And instead of, you know, allowing people to direct their energy and building these communities in an alternative to capitalism, they said, well, why don't we give them historical societies? Why don't we give them a day like, you know, Black History Month? Why don't we have some Black excellence? Amanda Seales put it beautifully. She said, instead of allowing Black people to empower themselves, let's give them some powerful Black people, right? Let's pick a few individuals, make them famous, make them wealthy, make them influential, and say, hey, look, Black excellence, put your effort that you would normally use, your momentum, into building your community, and instead divert it towards these gods, these idols, these people that you are going to now live vicariously through. Don't empower your community. Empower these 10 individuals that we're going to make famous, and you can live out your success through their success of becoming millionaires and influential and well-known. That's the theory. That's how they use social judo against the Black community. And unfortunately, it worked, just like it worked with the Latino community and the white community, for that matter. Even the white community, poor whites, instead of living poor whites, instead of empowering poor white communities, what do? You live through Donald Trump. Donald Trump is your success. Don't worry about your neighborhood. Don't worry about your family and friends and how they're going to suffer. Donald Trump is he's getting stuff done. He's getting W's for himself. He's making business deals for his friends. Just live through his happiness. And that's how white people have been co-opted, poor white communities. So same thing. Anyways.
I love it. I love hearing you talk about all this kind of stuff. I actually feel like I'm on an episode of Colonial Outcast. I love it.
I don't know if that's a good thing.
Talking about the... So moving on, continuing with the Black Party Panther, you actually recently joined the Panther Party, and let me know if this is correct. You actually started a chapter of the Panther Party in your area. Is that correct?
So we're forming a chapter. We're starting the building process. So I live in Southern California, not as south as San Diego. San Diego has chapters of the Panther Party and Black Panther Party. Central Committee is up in Tacoma, Washington. So that's who I answer to directly is Central Committee. And we're me and another friend who I met through Amanda Seals, somebody who recognized me at a rally. We decided we're going to start building chapters in this part, stretching from LA to the Arizona border. So that's our goal. And that's who we're trying to, that's what we're trying to do right now. We're beginning the process. Before that, I was more or less contributing and organizing with the National Central Committee on some projects that we're going to roll out. And I can talk about those in detail at some point in this conversation. But yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, the Panthers have always been painted as like a scary term by media outlets, you know, since what, like the 70s or something like that, maybe 60s. But it's misrepresented. Misrepresentation has been a tool to keep the people separated, as what you had mentioned before. Could you tell me a little bit about your experience with the Panther Party and like what they're about?
I can tell you that the Central Committee and the Panthers are the best way I can describe them in a sentence is they're like a Jedi Council. They're very much like a wise council of Jedi masters. They are very calm. They're calm. They're wise. They're not reactionary. They're very philosophical, but also very street minded. And that's what impressed me so much about them was that they were able to, instead of being armchair theorists, they're street. They merge the two. What's happening in reality on the ground amongst working class folks and theory itself. So they're very, so that was immediately I realized I found my political home, because everything else I was not ever satisfied with. It wasn't real. None of it's real. But the Panthers, I immediately saw the wisdom behind it. They're very wise, and it's built on love. That's one of the first things they told me before I joined is like, look, the key point is we are built on love of the people. They said, like a parting message they gave to me to let me think about whether I wanted to join or not. They said, hey, do me a favor. Whether or not you decide to join, do me this favor. Every day I want you to tell somebody that you love them. It could be your dog. Even if you don't live with anybody, if it's your dog, whatever, just make sure that you tell them never to leave somebody without telling you love them. And they believe, but they combine when we talk about like the radical part of the Black Panthers and the Panthers, their belief is that you cannot be full of love without being radical. Love is radical, because you can easily tell somebody that you love them, but that has to come with action. You can't just tell somebody you love them. You can't just feel it in your heart. It requires action, meaning you want them to be prosperous. You want them to be fed, sheltered, free, mentally healthy. You want that. That's what real love is. And so, and it goes kind of like with Islam has the same concept when they salam alaikum. It's not, salam doesn't mean to speak peace, bro. Peace on you. It means it's well-being, serenity, prosperity, safety, all that stuff, so justice, all that you're imparting them that on them. It's not a simple, hey, I love you, bro. So that's, I guess, very abstract opinion is on joining them before I get into the details about them.
Yeah, for sure. I actually had kind of a side little thing I was going to ask you about this too. So I've actually talked about like Stokely Carmichael and Kwame Ture. and how they argued that the United States lacked a conscience, making nonviolence like less effective in challenging its oppressive system. So like going on these like No Kings protests and everything like that, like, you know, it's just there's something that's not very effective about it. You know, I actually thumbed through, you suggested looking at the U8.net mm-hmm. and the Four Winds Approach to the Revolution. I actually thumbed.
Oh, good. You took a look at it.
I did take a look at it. I thumbed through it.
Awesome.
I thumbed through the website, and I honestly can get behind a lot of what they have on there. I mean, they talk about like creating community, connecting among your neighbors, like regardless of your ethnic background or political standing, as well as lifting up, you know, the poor, the sick, the vulnerable, the forgotten. You know, if Christians actually follow the teachings of Jesus, we should already be doing this. You know, honestly, absolutely. The Four Winds Approach feels more like MLK than Stokely Carmichael and Kwame Ture. However, I do understand like the respect of like bearing arms and, you know, how much, you know, having arms within your household and stuff like that to protect in case something does actually, you know, mm-hmm. a hostile takeover does happen with like a authoritarian, you know, takeover or something. But the like MLK's reliance on nonviolence as a means of achieving social change was flawed because it assumed the opponent would respond with a sense of morality. You know, maybe you could like, you know,
and I believe that changed later in his life.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it did change a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I was wondering if you could maybe tell me like, how are some ways that like myself or, you know, others listening could get involved into bringing like actual change to an oppressive system that we already have today?
Well, it starts, you have to start simple. If you get too ambitious, you'll burn out and then you'll lose the plot and you'll get lost in the sauce. It starts with your neighbor. Just like Jesus said, if we're talking to a Christian audience, Jesus said, love your neighbor and whoever that neighbor is. So the people who are immediately in your physical vicinity, because I believe because there's a lot of issues that are way out there that's hard for you to affect from a distance. Some are, but you start with your neighborhood. Where do you lay your head at night? That is where you need to start making the change. And in the U8, in the Four Winds Approach to Revolution, that's where I start. I start with... And I called it the Four Winds because you're going to reach out to your four neighbors to the north, the south, the east, and the west. That's your immediate sphere of influence. That's who you can help. And you just start by getting to know them first and asking them, what are you struggling with? What is something that you need in your life right now? Just throw it out. Even if you can't help them with these things, just ask them what are you struggling with, you know? And they'll tell you, hopefully. And then you get these groups, these neighbors together in a room, and then you start talking about your problems. Start talking about what solutions could one of us in this group of four or five if we can help you out with your problem. And then before you know it, something magical happens. People start to feel a sense of belonging, and they feel a sense of value because not only does somebody care about them, but they might have a solution to somebody else's problems. And that gives them a sense of value. And then you start to pose the question, do y'all want to collectivize a few things? Like, we don't have to collectivize everything, but like, let's throw in some money into a pot. Let's buy something big that all of us need that we can all share. Let's start sharing resources. Do you know anybody that can help me out with this? Blah, blah. And what that does is it creates a micro model. You create this cell, this very revolutionary cell that's tight-knit. You have your own code language. You have your own communication system. You have your own self-defense system. Everything is in this small cell of four houses. And the goal is then you want to link that up with the next four houses. And but you don't, like I said, the reason why you start so small is A, it makes it manageable. It makes it realistic. Mm-hmm. And then it can be replicated and it can expand very quickly. And if you can get the whole neighborhood to start doing that, maybe a few houses won't want to participate, but that's okay. It's okay. I mean, like you're not forcing people to do this as voluntary, but people will want to be part of it because people want to feel the village again. We've lost the village in this country. We've lost the village that the early disciples had. They had the village. The early Christians had a system, a village, and we've lost that. And so this takes care of that problem of not having the village anymore because now you're collectivizing within a neighborhood and that's the beginning phases of revolution. Now, if everybody's doing this, if every neighborhood is doing this across the country and it spreads like wildfire, Well, now we're ready for revolution. We're getting more and more prepared for it. Full-on detachment from the capitalist system, and we're ready to rebel. And the rebellion part is the part that we're afraid of, right? It's the violent part. It's the bloody part. It's the taking up arms. But that's the point of building these communities. You don't want it to be violent. The more you can build the community, the less violent and bloody is going to be when we finally decide to rebel, because you're going to have this strong network and it's going to be hard for the elites to try and conquer that. So you want to get enough people to give up on trying to conquer you. And you can only do that by creating a tight-knit community. So that's what I would say about answering the question about radical resistance and violence and the importance of building community is so that you can avoid as much bloodshed as possible, you know?
Yeah, and it's been said on the show before is not to build higher fences, but to build longer tables, you mm-hmm. know, bringing people together, you know, bringing those food ideas together.
Absolutely.
But I mean, that's what the table is all about. It's about bringing people together over food, but it definitely does create that collectivism, that understanding of your neighbor and to bring people together so you can create that community and establish, you know, what needs are and that sort of thing. So
yes,
I think it's beautiful that, like, you know, what you said, and then that like the Panther Party in general, that's what they're all about. Even though they've been demonized, like, you know, it's just beautiful that there's an establishment, an organization that has these sort of principles in mind for, you know, thinking about this kind of stuff. So,
yeah. Well, it's interesting you brought up the demonization of the Black Panthers. I'm glad you brought that up because it's a common misconception and needs to be addressed. So, and when I mentioned this to a lot of white people, white Christian people, people who aren't in politics or in theory or whatever, or in history, when I mentioned the Black Panthers, their first thought is that it's a black nationalist group, right? Mm-hmm. And I want to make it very clear that that is the biggest misconception. They are not nationalist. They are not a black nationalist group. There's plenty of those out there. They're about the working class. They're about cross-sectionalism. They want to break down the racial barriers. Black nationalist groups are all fed. They all have feds that run them, which is why you have groups like the New Black Panther Party. That is a black nationalist group, and it's fed. There's feds that run it. Those are psyops to prevent, you know, demographics from forming a solid hand, keep us divided. White nationalist groups, that's why all of them are run by feds. If you every white nationalist group turns out to be ran by feds, every black nationalist group turns out to be ran by feds. There's a pattern there because it's to keep us separate. So I want to make that very clear.
Well, it's kind of like why the KKK aren't established as terrorists, but like the Black Panther Party are, and like Antifa and stuff like that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yep.
Well, no, I mean, just what you said, they've been painted like, so in the interim, since the Black Panthers started back up again in 2020, and that since they were disbanded, I believe like 1980-ish was like when they're like officially disbanded. In that interim, the Empire had to fill the void with bad memories of the Black Panther. They had to fill, they didn't want people getting nostalgic about the Black Panthers. So they had to fill all that void in that space with like demonization, fear-mongering, lies, propaganda, anything to make sure that nobody starts something like that up ever again. And they were very good at it because they, you know, they control all the resources when it comes to media. They control all the bottlenecks of media. But now, like people like yourself, you're dismantling that hard work that they put into demonizing the Black Panther Party by having your podcast with, you know, Christian viewers who were probably given the wrong information for this for that long. So that's why it's very valuable of this decentralization of media, like podcasts like yours.
I mean, I've got a small listener base, but I know I hope to do my small little part into, you know, bringing a little bit more information into the sphere of here. So,
yeah.
You know, it's, I don't know. It's just this whole world has been giving me just a headache with everything. Everything. And then you talk about, you know, like Venezuela and everything going on there. And I know you've been talking about, I think you brought up on your show about like, what is it? Like CIA operation, you know, thwarted over there on the banks of Venezuela, trying to like fire on ships and whatnot. I don't know if you've heard anything more about that at all.
I haven't.
I thought that was like super interesting.
It was interesting.
No.
It was interesting. I haven't heard anything more on it. I haven't pursued it that much either, but I should. I mean, it's either way, I hope people believe it because the more people mm-hmm. believe that story, the more they'll, you know, realize that our government's capable of that. So I think it's great that people have a suspicious eye open for anything that could happen. So who knows if it's true, it would be in their character to do something like that.
Yeah. And I feel like this whole, you know, attempt to try to undermine Venezuela is just, you know, you've mentioned this on your show. It's like, it's bringing the people, the Venezuelan people together and collecting them, to form militias, you know, untrained militias, but like, you know, militias nonetheless to try to stop any U.S. involvement with trying to undermine the government and everything like that. And you see that with like, was it Ibrahim Traoré?
Burkina Faso.
Yeah. And I've actually talked about that country and him on my podcast too, as well, in another episode. And, you know, the revolution that he's kind of forming, and with the countries, the surrounding countries around his country, and kind of forming this like alliance. And then even just like the undermining of the US dollar. I think it was like last year, like there was like 13 countries or something like that that decided to devalue the US dollar and using their own currencies. Yep. And I mean, the revolution is happening worldwide. Mm-hmm. It's not just like here in America that people are, you know, protesting or anything like that. But there's many different facets around the world that are you know, forming coalitions and forming this resistance against the empire. Not just American empire. There's lots of other empires around the world that are doing this. So it's these little pockets that give people hope. And the more that we talk about it, the more that we inform people about what's going on and forming these smaller pockets. So you have more and more and more smaller pockets. That's like what you said is where the real revolution happens.
Yes.
You know, you think back to like the French Revolution and how did that happen? Well, the people talked and they formed coalitions and they got, you know, the entire populace behind so that they could, you know, create this revolution against the ruling empire. And it's cool to see these little pockets and to be able to talk to people like you about this kind of thing.
Oh yeah. No, it's what you're describing, these pockets forming everywhere, is exactly what Huey P. Newton wrote about in Revolutionary Intercommunalism. So the revolution, the only way that revolution globally is truly going to stick and be a tangible thing that lasts is if everybody, all these revolutionary groups, start to interlink with each other and we start to see the world, the whole world, as our family, meaning people struggling, a Palestinian resistance struggling against the Zionist empire over there. And we have to see their struggle as our struggle, and we have to see, you know, Burkina Faso's struggle to kick out the French imperialism that was over there. And we have to view what's happening in Sudan, the people who are, you know, falling prey to the RSF and the, you know, Emirati exploitation. We have to view all these things as interlinked, and it makes us stronger. It inspires us. There may be, like, think of the knowledge that Palestinian resistance could impart on all these other resistance groups worldwide that we could benefit from to know how to survive and better fight. Think of how the cross-pollination behind these revolutionary groups, instead of just seeing them as isolated and saying, oh, well, that's over there, that's their struggle, not ours. It's like, well, you're robbing yourself of so much valuable knowledge and inspiration on how to fight your own battles. Why would you rob yourself of that? Interlink. And that's what revolutionary intercommunalism was about. Like, we have to view all these struggles as one, or else we're cooked. Like, there's nothing. Like, we're being unstrategic, and we're being foolish, you know.
For sure. I don't know if you've seen this at all in the news, but Buddhist monks have actually started a walking journey from Austin, Texas to Washington, D.C. I think they started at the beginning of October. So they're somewhere in the middle of their journey right now. But typically when Buddhist monks get involved and start walking, you know, things are real. So Buddhist monks typically avoid directly getting involved with politics. But when injustice or suffering becomes impossible to ignore, like what's happening with ICE agents and everything else around the world, then Buddhist monks' response will have to have some kind of walking or pilgrimage or symbolic renunciation in conjunction with the community. Of course, this can be seen in like Vietnam, where the Buddhist monks were like under a Catholic-led regime, and they got involved where there was violence, arrests, bans on Buddhist flags, and they lit themselves on fire, which, you know, makes me think of what happened with like Aaron Bushnell, lighting himself on fire for the suffering of the Palestinian people. And, you know, that, so like I said, when they start walking, you know, things are real, you know, things have gotten to a point where they need to be, you know, talked about and dealt with, and that kind of revolutionary spirit really needs to be starting to take that root and get things done. So I don't know if you've seen that at all about the Buddhist monks.
I've heard of it. I learned about it a little bit about, definitely the self-immolation. It was where I think that particular moment when that monk lit himself on fire, he was doing it in protest because the South Vietnamese army banned Buddhist monks from joining the chaplaincy of the South Vietnamese army. They were not. It was only Catholics or Christians that were allowed to be chaplains. So that was particular focus of that one. But no, yeah, I mean, I think that, go back to your question. I was thinking of that.
There really was no question. It was just, I don't know if you've heard about that. I just found it really interesting when I saw that. I was like, man, if the Buddhist monks are getting involved, shit is real.
Yeah. No, I'm actually not aware of that. Of that, I would actually like to learn more about it. But yeah, if they're getting involved.
Yeah. You probably look it up.
I haven't gone down that rabbit hole, believe it or not. That's interesting. I learned something.
Yeah. You know? So continuing on with like Catholic, and just like Christian, you know, maybe I can incorporate some of these ideas and kind of terms with you. So I don't know if you've heard of Thomas Aquinas at all. Have you ever heard of him?
No.
So he's a saint in the Catholic Church. It was in the 13th century. He was a philosopher and theologian.
Okay.
He had a very large grand work called the Summa Theologica. And in that, so it's a very unique way of, so he created like these four different paragraphs, and you have to read them in certain order. Like, you can't start with like the top left one down, you know, reading like that. Hmm. You have to start with the summary, which is the bottom one. And then there's like a certain way that you have to kind of jump around to the different paragraphs.
Interesting.
But essentially he asked a question whether it's okay to take someone else's something that is someone else's. So like their personal property,
right?
Like when you are in need.
Right.
So he actually answers this. It says, in cases of necessity, all things are common property, and therefore it's not even theft or robbery to take what you need from the rich. Whatever people have in superabundance is owed by natural law to the poor. He also then quotes another philosopher and theologian in the church named Ambrose, who said that the bread that you store belongs to the hungry. The cloak that you lock away belongs to the naked, and the money that you bury in the ground is the ransom to the poor. I feel like when I heard all this, I was like, I need to bring this up to you, because I feel like this is like the kind of stuff that you and Greg talk about a lot on the show.
Yeah, well, but like Jesus, I mean, it goes along with what Jesus said about, you know, if you have an extra cloak, give it away. If you have, you know, feed the hungry, feed, you know. So the yes, so one thing that people are scared of when they think about, I guess, revolution and us eating the rich or whatever, is that they think that a lot of average Americans who may be upper middle class, maybe upper class, they think that it means them, that we're coming for all the upper middle class family homes and going to take away their cars, their flat screen TV or something like that. What's interesting, like, and what's the what I try to tell people is, what I try to educate people on, is that there's so much wealth that has been diverted to the billionaires. We wouldn't even have to, like, nobody has to touch anybody, not even millionaires. Millionaires wouldn't even be touched. We're just talking about literally like 10 people at the very top that have, you know, a collective of trillions of dollars, that if we were to, and they weren't, this wealth was not earned. It was not gained honestly. It was stolen. This was wealth that was stolen from just average people worldwide. People were killed for that money. People were robbed for that money. They used bribery to get that money. it was not honest possessions that were gained. So we're not even talking about redistributing wealth from people who worked hard and accumulated a lot of money. That's a different story. And like, we don't even have to go there. Like, we're simply talking about people who robbed the world, killed for it, murdered for it, mass murdered for it, and then they have it in their coffers. We're just saying we're going to take all that back. We're going to get justice for all that back. Before you even get to the conversation of, okay, how do we create an equitable society where everybody's taken care of? Like, if we took the wealth back that was stolen from us, the normal working class across the world, where everybody, just anybody around the world that's not a billionaire, if we took that back, we would have enough to sustain everybody for the next 200 years before we could even think about having to think about like figuring out how we'll like redistribute wealth or take care of each other. Like, it's, we just have to take back what was stolen, you know? And that's why I feel like is the huge fallacy behind the conversation about redistribution of wealth and eating the rich. The biggest fallacy is we approach it from the standpoint that we are taking from the rich and redistributing it just because it's fair, or because, you know, they don't need that much money. It's like, no, the simple point is they stole that stuff. They got it dishonestly and people died for it. We are taking that back and giving it back to the people that they stole it from in the first place. So that's where I get frustrated with the conversation that people have, you know, when you have a capitalist and a communist arguing with each other, it gets crazy like that, you know?
Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you wouldn't mind if I actually close with this poem by a man named Dietrich Bonhoeffer. I don't know if you've heard of Dietrich Bonhoeffer at all.
I haven't. No.
So he was a scholar, theologian, a professor in Nazi Germany, during the rise of Nazi Germany. And he spoke out considerably against the Nazi party. Mm-hmm. And he was actually targeted from that and actually imprisoned and everything like that. Before all that happened, he actually took a trip to America. He met up with a French nationalist at the time, and they had a lot of theological discussions, changed his mind, everything like that. And then he actually spent a lot of time in the black church here in America, and actually shaped him considerably into who he became after he left America. And when he came back to Germany, of course, the rise of Nazis in the 1930s, and he spoke out considerably, joined the Confessing Church, which spoke out again against the Nazi party. He joined a underground movement that essentially created a plot to assassinate Hitler. It was a failed attempt. It was the plot that were, I'm sure you've heard of the one where they put the bomb in the Valkyrie. Yeah. So he was a part of that movement. There's a writer named Eric Metaxas that wrote a book, and he calls it the Bonhoeffer moment, and which has been very denounced by just about every single Bonhoeffer scholar, even though he's still revered in the Christian world, which is ridiculous. That's another conversation.
That's interesting. I didn't know any of that.
So while Bonhoeffer was imprisoned, it was about 9 months before he was assassinated by the state. He wrote a poem, and it was called Night Voices. You have to look it up. I'm going to read you a portion of it. It's actually a pretty long poem, but I'm going to read you a portion here, and I feel like it's going to resonate with you. And if you think about like the Palestinian people, or like anyone else that is being oppressed around the world, I feel like this poem kind of, I feel like you could read this into any situation like that. So here it is. He says, "We accuse those who thrust us into sin, who made us share their guilt, who made us witnesses to injustice, so they could despise the partners in their crime. They made us look on heinous acts to entangle us in the snarl of guilt. Then we were muzzled and became the silent dog. We learned to tell cheap lies, to go along with the obvious wrongdoing. When violence was heaped on the defenseless, we looked away. And what set our hearts aflame, we kept silent and unnamed. We quenched our burning blood and stamped out our sense of shame. What once joined humankind in sacred bonds was shredded and defaced. Betrayed were friendships and faithfulness, rueful tears, the target of scorn. We, the offspring of devout generations, once the defenders of justice and truth, became despisers of God and humanity, as hell looked on, laughing. Yet though now robbed of freedom and honor, before humankind proudly we raise our heads. And when we are slandered maliciously, before humankind we acquit ourselves, free. I go with you, brother, to that place, and I hear your last word. Brother, when the sunlight I no longer see, do live for me. Brothers, until our day breaks, after the long night, we will stand fast.
It's great.
So when I read that, I was like, man, I got to share this with Mark, because I've been reading through the Letters and Papers from Prison by Bonhoeffer. It's his last works. Mm. Man, when I read that, I was like, I got to share that with you.
That's very powerful. Yeah. I'm glad. I learn stuff, new stuff every day. Bonhoeffer, never heard of him. So that's a really interesting history. I got to look into that. What denomination was he?
He was Lutheran. So Lutheran. Germans are known for being Lutherans.
Lutheran. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Gotcha. Yeah. That's interesting. It's so true. It's very true. No, absolutely. I would leave off with, you know, I don't know what your audience looks like, what the demographics are of your audience, but I would say that if you really want to put, you know, love to action when it comes to community on a scale that's in a system that's scalable, that you can scale up as opposed to simple acts of kindness, which we should do anyways, I would encourage you to go to u8.net and look at the Four Winds Plan for Revolution. And if you would like to film it, the way we want to distribute this plan, the way we want to create the viral social trend, is we want people to print off the QR code, and when they're in the grocery store, leave some money for the person behind them, and then leave the QR code, and then that QR code will lead to the website that has the plan. And hopefully we can create like a social media trend of people just bragging about, hey, look, I gave this money to this person. And it's a way of, because I feel like the way we've approached revolution and reaching people and educating people, I believe we've done it backwards. See, the Black Panthers, they didn't just come out and ask people to care, right? Which is what most movements do. We go out and we say, hey, can you please care about Palestine? Do you know what's happening in Palestine? Here's a flyer. Here's the information. That's great. You can educate a lot of people that way and reach a lot of people, but it's even more powerful is when you show people that you care first about them, you give them something, and then they are now more inclined to care about what you care about, because you've shown first that, hey, you're not just some, you know, job I'm getting over with it's not a one-way street. I'm not just giving you some information and pushing my views or my message onto you. I'm first telling you, hey, I want to give you something because I care about you as a human being. And now they feel seen. They feel cared for. So now they're more inclined to care about what you care about. And I feel like that's one of the most lethal forms of protest. That's why the Black Panthers first gave to the community, offered them stuff before they asked them to be revolutionaries and care. They wanted to do it. So for your Christians out there, you know, your true Christians out there who are watching this, you know, you're familiar with this philosophy. You know, Jesus asked you to care about people first before you can ask them to care about you. Be a servant before you can be a leader, you know. So I'll leave it off on that.
I love that. I know you mentioned u8.net, and of course, whoever is listening, you know, go there, check it out, do what you can to, you know, get involved if you feel comfortable. Also, if people want to find you specifically, Mark, where can they find you?
Well, you can go to colonialoutcast.com. That will have all of our socials. You'll see all of our socials on there. So colonialoutcast.com. It's a beta. We're doing a beta test on this website. It's pretty simple, pretty minimalistic, but it'll have all the links. And I'm on Instagram. Mark Wayne Director is my handle. But yeah, check out the podcast. And yeah, and it's stay true to the path. You know, Christianity is a path. It's not a life insurance policy. You don't just take the badge and put it on. It's a path. You have to walk it. Just like Islam. I tell my Muslim friends or people who revert to Islam that I talk to, my friends, I said, listen, I always remind people, these are like new reverts to Islam. I tell them, look, Islam is a path. You got to walk it every day. It's not just a selfish, you know, redemption for yourself. You need to look at your religion as a path. You need to be a Muslim every day. You need to walk that path, you know? And I will say that Islam guided my Christianity at a young age. You know, when I met Palestinians, Islam taught me that my version of Christianity, or the version that I left behind, was the wrong one. They taught me what it means to be a true Christian because they actually live the words of Jesus. Muslims, the biggest difference between them and American Christians, or at least Western Christians that I've noticed, is that they revere Jesus's commandments and they walk it every day because they revere Jesus. They revere Jesus more than Christians revere Jesus. They revere his words. They revere his commandments. Whereas we simply revere him as a symbol, a cultural, an idol, yeah. A cultural item, a brand, you know. Muslims walk that path that Jesus laid before them more than Christians do. And that's what guided my Christianity. So
I love that. I think it's a great way, a great segue off of this. Mark, thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate your time and just your energy to put towards this. Be sure to check him out. He's got some great content, him and Greg Stoker on a Colonial Cast. So be sure to do that. Thanks, Mark.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mark. Appreciate you.
That's it for today's episode of Grub and Grace. I hope you enjoyed our discussion with Mark Wayne. I want to give a big thank you to Mark for joining me on this episode. Until next time, stay curious, keep an open mind, and celebrate the traditions that bring us all together.